That's South Africa's West Nkosi, songwriter, producer, band leader, saxophonist or saxophonist, whichever way you prefer to pronounce it, and master penny whistle player. Yes, penny whistle. And an ardent proponent of township jive with mazuzu, meaning young woman. It's from his 1993 album, Rhythm of Healing. Nkosi produced and managed Ladysmith Black Mambazo until they came to international acclaim in 1987. He also produced all of the international releases for Mahalatini and the Mahotela Queens up until 1991. He was paralyzed in an automobile accident in August of 1998 and died from his injuries 2 months later. He was 58 years old. But by then, of course, he had made his mark. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. We're getting off to a little late start, but because we wanted to share with you that insightful conversation between Gary Null and Andrew Harvey. Really interesting thing about brilliant minds. They always have some way of elevating all of us, and I thought it was really important to share that. So thanks, Gary, for that interview. Well, let's get on with our business. It's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. You know what it is. It's 888-874-4888. This is our weekly caucus about the system and on the system. And you call 888-874-4888 to get started. What happened this past week that you can help us put into proper perspective to enlighten us? Not just about the news, but it's a free forum. It's totally unscripted. You are the person driving this bus. So what have you to say? Lots and lots happened this week. And we ought to engage in some kind of an understanding to advance our ideas and our thoughts and our actions in the future based on what you contribute to this wonderful soup, intellectual soup. Bring your own little flavor to it, and let's go. 888-874-4888. Let's start off in California. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice.
Hello, wonderful Harvey. What's you saying today?
Well, I'd like to talk about the three most terrifying words in the English language today. And the words are runaway greenhouse effect. And I invite your audience to look them up, do the research. Some planetary geologist thinks that our Earth's nearest neighbor, Venus, was the victim of a runaway greenhouse effect, which turns our sister planet into a boiling hell that we see today. And new research has shown us why increasing global temperatures are more dangerous than previously thought. We humans are now responsible for emitting 10 billion tons of carbon into our atmosphere annually. And some climate scientists say that even if we burn 10 times the amount of all the fossil fuels on Earth into the atmosphere, it still won't trigger a runaway greenhouse effect, which would create a surface temperature of hundreds of degrees. Just like on Venus. But I believe that their argument is wrong because we don't need to burn all of the world's coal, oil, and natural gas to initiate a runaway greenhouse effect. The problem is that as our planet's temperature soars, the burning of fossil fuels, a secondary effect kicks in, such as the rapid melting of the Earth's permafrost, which releases vast amounts of methane into the atmosphere. And methane, which turns the sun's infrared radiation into atmospheric heat, is at least 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And at the same time, as the temperature rises, carbon that's locked up in the Earth's rocks and soil gets released into the air, further accelerating the plant's atmospheric temperature. But the most powerful greenhouse gas that's never mentioned is water vapor. Water vapor absorbs the sun's infrared rays and admits it into our atmosphere as heat. And the hotter the atmosphere gets, the more water vapor is evaporated off the planet's rivers, lakes, and oceans. This creates a atmospheric heat loop, which causes even more evaporation until the atmosphere gets so hot that our planet's oceans, lakes, and rivers boil off. And at the same time, over 400 nuclear plants around the world, And most of them use a what they call is a once-through cooling system, like the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant here in California that sucks in 2.5 billion gallons of seawater a day, heats it up 20 degrees before dumping it back in the ocean. Or they use the giant cooling towers that release vast amounts of water vapor into our atmosphere. So by using all of these fossil fuels, we're heating our planet's atmosphere at an unsustainable rate, and we must leave what's left of the fossil fuels in the ground and turn to clean, renewable energy production as fast as possible or suffer planetary runaway greenhouse effect. And I want to thank President Obama for doing all he can to foster a switch to non-water-using clean, renewable energy. We don't have much time left to make the switch. It's change or die. It's time to just say no to climate destruction of our home planet, Mother Earth. It's time to get star-powered, and I say let's get solar.
Thank you so much for getting us started today, and always with a lot of information. From New York, Patricia, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrecht, and good afternoon to the PRN family.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you.
Thank you. I still am transfixed with the president's speech in Cuba this week. It's almost as if I just can't get it out of my gray matter, not my hair, but my gray matter. I listened to all of the things he told the Cuban people, especially the youth, that they had a right to. He talked about the education of not only boys but girls. He talked about the fact that they should have access to an open internet and about the fact that, internet companies like Google, were willing to wire the island. Thank God Castro said thanks, but no thanks, because, I'm certain he's aware that, like Cabo and Becky used to say, we're like Greeks bearing gifts. We bear gifts with one hand and then we infect it with something else. But I thought about all the educational opportunities he said those children had a right to, and I have never heard him talk about that here at home regarding black and brown children. And I said, well, wait a minute, what about our kids? Our kids don't deserve a right to good education. They don't deserve a right to an open and free internet. He is supporting this whole policy of net neutrality where the internet and cable companies, you got to pay to play so that you can get fast internet. Well, what about us right here in the United States? We don't count. We don't have any economic value. We don't have any value at all to you that you can go over there and say what they have a right to, but you can't talk about what we have a right to right here in your home. And I said, how dishonest and how deceitful can you be? But you want to know something? Black folks, we have so few heroes and heroines in our lives. We will just take anybody. Just anybody. And so you can't say a word about this president. Whenever I try to articulate some of the things that he is doing, I get cut down at the ankles. Forget the knees. They don't want me to be left with anything.
They go for the ankles. That's how low they want to cut you down.
Yeah. So we don't believe in homegrown heroes who are not corruptible. We don't believe in that. We really don't.
Well, it's been a while since we saw such an entity. We haven't seen one of those in a long, long time. So people probably don't even know what they look like anymore.
You're probably correct. But, I think about the congresswoman from Georgia, Carolyn McKinney. She was homegrown, and we turned our backs. And you look at somebody like Alton, we turn our backs. So even when we have them in our midst, we don't recognize them for who they are. And, of course, the propaganda that is waged against them is so strong, obviously quite effective, because we can't recognize them, we can't see them. So, it's almost understandable that if you are homegrown, that you would be somewhat reluctant to put your foot out there. But, at the same time, I look at Alton, you got to be ready to sacrifice. And most people are not willing to pay that price because it's a very, very high price that one pays.
Yes, and you know, you have to also keep in mind, Patricia, that one of the aspects of oppression is that the oppressor tells you who your friends are and mm-hmm. who your enemies are.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically, your mind has, whatever is left of it has already been made up. And you operate on somebody else's orders, somebody else's conditioning, somebody else fashioning your thought process, even as it relates to your own interests, your own lives. So it takes a heavy toll, and that is why I continue to say this thing that we call racism, which is a very mild name for it, is a science. It's an applied science. It yields exactly the same result wherever this formula is applied. And in the United States, it literally has developed the template in modern times of how you control vast numbers of people by controlling their thought process.
Absolutely correct.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Love to hear from you. Gino from New York, you're on the air.
Oh, well, Eutrice Lead, a woman who I've been listening to for many years.
Hello, Gino.
Hi. Usually I go to work when I'm getting ready to go to work when you're on. So I finally got to. First of all, congratulations on 1 year.
Thank you.
100 more to go?
That's right. That's my attitude.
I know you got a good attitude, even from your diagnosis to your processing. I mean, your spirit is strong, and that's the biggest key of all.
It is the biggest weapon against this disease, no question about it.
Yeah, I remember Swami Satchidananda, the one who opened Woodstock, he said the greatest thing to be concerned about with any disease is fear. It's the worst. So you certainly got the opposite of that. You got that love factor going, and it's working.
Thank you.
You're
so
welcome.
What
You're
kind true. Of flavor are you bringing to this soup today?
Oh, I would say the rainbow flavor, the one of each of the seven colors. Eutrice, I want to get a book to you. But the thing, and I may even be able to get a great author on for you. I'll be seeing him in June down in Virginia Beach, and I'm sure he'd be happy to be on your show. Basically, the lady before you, and by the way, you have a great audience. Harvey from California, hello out there, wonderful Harvey. And that lady you have out there in Texas, and Matt, and the one before, you get some great, family of callers there. I really admire that.
And put yourself in the midst of it all, too.
I jumped in, finally. I jumped in, making a splash. So what I want to say to you, I know you've done the thing and you're doing the thing with the eating right for your body. I know you probably know a bit about the second level with the meditation and getting tuned up with the instrument that you have of your beingness and letting the spirit, you know, attenuate those vibrations and just communing with that. The greatest person I know, like unsung heroes, that inspired me, I just hit half of Moses' age, 60. So and I've looked back in these past 42 years, I've been inspired by God through this man. Do you know much about Edgar Cayce?
Yes.
What do you know of him?
Well, some people call him a mystic. But others call him a very insightful person, a visionary, who brings a whole different dimension to our understanding of our being, essentially.
You're right. And like you were saying about Andrew Harvey before, with Gary, a wonderful speaker. I'll give you a quick, what I've learned, and I could encapsulate it a bit. 8th grade educated man, did not go home and read, but knew more than anybody teaching on any topic at any university. Worked with people who were given up by doctors, told they're going to die or be in pain for their life, and they didn't want to hear that as the final diagnosis. They would write him a letter. He didn't want to know anything about you consciously because he didn't understand it. He'd write a letter, and he'd say, Gino, be in your home 7:30. He's in Virginia Beach. I write him a letter. Can you help me? Doctors don't say good things. Gino, be at home 7:30 in a prayerful state Thursday. I'll be home. He'd see the weather in New York. He'd see my apartment. He'd see what I'm wearing. He'd see through my body. What's wrong, what doctor to go to, what has to be done. I go knock on Dr. Kugawami's door, and who are you? Gino, who sent you? Casey, who's that? How does he know I'm even here? I just arrived. I'm not even advertised. Now, four people that most people don't know about him, but four people who we do know about who went to him were Franklin Roosevelt, World War II, Woodrow Wilson, World War I. They both had their physical ailments that they weren't being helped too much for. But he also gave world readings because he could see in Hitler's brain. And he did warn against the bankers, too, even back then. And Thomas Edison, Nikola Tesla, Houdini, never exposed him, watched the movie Return to Curtis, exposing all the fake mediums, never exposed him, was a good friend. William James's cohort, Dr. Munstenberger at Harvard, went down there to expose him. He said, young man, I don't know what you're doing, but whatever you're doing, keep it up, because he interviewed people who helped when the doctors couldn't help him. He was a Bible teacher, but he was kicked out of church after 55 years of teaching school, Sunday school and church, because he was manifesting the gifts of the Spirit. It's one thing to talk about it like a parrot, but when you manifest, that's when they don't know whether you're on this side of it or that side. Even
so let me ask you, Gino, yes. What have you distilled from the teachings of Edgar Cayce that has importance in your life?
Well, how to have life more abundant. I mean, to know that people exist in our time, you know, another unsung genius, you know, George Washington Carver, meditated every morning at 4, rediscovered the color purple found in ancient Egypt. He was good friends with Gandhi, made food for Gandhi. This is a man who was a spiritual giant, but we don't know much about him because they just focus on peanut butter. He did 300 things with the peanut, but he was a spiritual genius. He communed with the spirit. He would talk with the flowers. These people, in other words, they don't want us to know about these people. If they had said, you know, spaceship is coming and it don't come, let's drink Kool-Aid and everybody dies, there's a movie made 2 months later. But the great ones, the Paramahansa Yogananda, who taught Gandhi how to meditate, he was in the West Coast in the 20s and Casey in the East Coast, these people show by experience what is possible with us, not with other alien beings, with us, the authentic self in us. So what did he give to me? He predicted the Dead Sea Scrolls for 2,000 years. The brainiacs didn't think the Essenes were important. He said they'll find them what they say. He died in 45. The scrolls were found in 47. The brainiacs, it took them 55 years to admit Mary, Joseph, and John the Baptist were members of the Essenes up in Mount Carmel. They were vegetarian. They meditated. They didn't say because we're Jewish, we have nothing in common with the Arabians or the Persians. They knew the Lord our God is one. So what did he do for me? The first book I read, There Is a River, about his life, it was the first book to ever put a tear in my eye. I didn't believe what I read, but it touched me until I put into practice what he said about meditation, learn how to do it like we learned how to walk and talk. It took me 3 months to learn, just through books and practice, until I got a taste of it, and I've been doing it ever since. And it feeds me, like Jesus said the last night to the disciples, pray and meditate, and they fell asleep 3 times. It gives you life more abundant. It gives us access beyond our conditioned mind to go through the conscious, so-called, through the subconscious wilderness, to the superconscious, that witness watching our dreams as we're sleeping, and make that body one. The Lord our God is one. It's very practical. And that we can be used to bring love and hope and inspiration into this world of such suffering and more to come, as we know. But we get the strength to deal with it. Whether the earth cracks open in front of us, instead of getting a heart attack, we help somebody. We are of the God being. We are of the light. We are children of God. And I guess today being Passover reminder, you know, who else in the history do we know that it led such a... Now, I'm not involved with one particular box anywhere, because to me the whole planet is sacred. And our temple is our bodies. And like ancient Egypt, they weren't stupid. In the center of the earth, they put the pyramid, guarded by the Sphinx, a lion head and a human head and a lion body, guide our animal nature. And then we get access to the Holy of Holies, that outward reminder, a pyramid, which means pyra, fire in the middle. And look at everybody, when you take a deep breath, look in the mirror, look at that pyramid in your rib cage. You get access to the solar system, solar plexus. The energies go up the spine. You contact, like where Jacob wrestled with the angel, a place called Peniel. You contact in the third eye, in the forehead. You contact the spirit connecting with our soul, and we actually see things without a phone call.
The spirit is a very, very important part of the self, and it really is worth the journey to one's self. It really is worth it.
Without
that,
yes.
It is an incredibly rewarding process, and I thank you for contributing that thought today.
Thanks for calling in. God bless you. Keep accepting, and thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Let's go to South Carolina. Khalil, you're on the air.
You know, it's amazing. I was cooking lunch yesterday, and I sometimes I listen to Gary Nolan, sometimes I don't. And then he brought up your story, and it was so funny because for the past couple of times I've talked to you, I've been wanting to ask about what was going on, but I could tell by your tonal affect, your affect, you know, nobody wants to be bothered with that all the time. So then he brought it up. I mean, seriously, I'm just trying to be real. You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to be real.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I've been following you now, and time flies. I think I've been listening for at least 2 years now. So I remember this, and I'm telling all my old people, because all the women in my family, I'm the only man in my family now, right? And all these women have been affected by different types of breast, you know, cancers, breast cancer, different types of, that's some serious,
You
know.
that's serious.
I mean, bro, this is some real doo-doo we're talking about. This is not, you know, we're talking about some real stuff here, right?
Yeah.
This is powerful information. And people, that's what I'm saying. I'm spreading to these people, and I've always been saying this. If you ever get cancer, anytime somebody says chemo, walk away. F that. No. Period. No. Don't do it. Ha. All right. I had to get that out. So,
okay.
Serendipity is a, you know what? So that just, you know, that's why we're a community. You know, seriously, that's why we're a community. But, and Patricia, you have some really excellent callers.
I think so. I think it's a great classroom, actually. I so look forward to it. Sometimes people call me and say, oh, that was a great show. And I say, yeah, it was. I didn't get to talk too much. And that's exactly what makes it great. You know, people have so much to offer. All we have to do is to just sit back and listen to what they're trying to share. And it is the best kind of peer-to-peer education you can get. I always have loved that about radio. For all the years that I've been doing radio, I try to make it so that people have space to participate and create community by just engaging with each other, which is something that you don't find much anymore. People want to talk, but the hosts want to talk. And sometimes, you know, I do go off, but I really do like the idea of people cross-pollinating with each other and sharing ideas.
Well, that being said, now that I mean, like I said, serendipity, sometimes I believe in coincidence and sometimes I don't. But on a serious note, since it's free your mind, I believe, we have to come, the United States, honestly, we have to get to the point where we can be honest and ask ourselves a question. Why is it that Israel is the only country that we recognize, you know, the G10, you know, of all the countries in the UN, the countries who are supposed to be civilized and whatnot? That's the best way I can say that, right? How come they are continually sanctioned by the UN and no one says anything about it? It's like, whatever. Now, if Iran did that, it's a big deal. You see? And every time we hear occupy, remember, please, translate that. That's a spin. Occupy means stolen land. Okay? Let's get it correct, people. Get it correct. And because people as I do not agree with what the government of Israel is doing, does not mean you condone people who do not like Israelis or Jews. That's a totally different subject. See, because we live in a big world, and we forget. Americans, really, on average, we're average. Most of the world is multilingual or polylingual. They see what we see. There's a reason that people do not like us. Okay? You got these jackasses like Donald Trump running around saying crazy things. People see that around the world. Okay? And unless you live in a country, just like we see what happened when Benjamin gets up, Benjamin gets up and says crazy stuff, we see that. But he doesn't really reflect most Israelis. Most Israelis don't agree with him. He's far right, just like Ted Cruz or, well, other people are far right and religious zealots, you know. So we have to remember that. And a good example is black Americans, because when you get off that plane, when you go abroad, you're another nigger. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor, a lawyer, a judge, because people see TV. See, people, TV is powerful. That is exactly why Donald Trump is where he is. Okay? Because perception is a lot. Perception trumps reality and facts. So every time you hear occupied territory and settlers and this kind of nonsense, remember, that's stolen land. You go to the store with your friends, you know, you're getting high, you're drinking beer, let's go get a pizza. Fine, let's go get a pizza. On the way home, yeah, I want a pizza. I'm hungry. All right. When you get home, there's three slices left. And one person says, well, those are mine. Well, no, they're not, because we all ate this. You can't have what's left like that. No. Well, they're mine. No, they're not. So, you know, we have to have this honest conversation, because these are our tax dollars.
Well, you brought it to us, so let's see how people react. Thank you, Khalil, for contributing today. Let's go to Rosedale, New York. And Jose, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, my professor. And as always, ancestral blessings to you always.
Thank you so much, and the same to you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Now, I would just like to piggyback a little bit on yesterday's conversation about our president's speech. And I'm of the opinion, as the president has said, that if you're doing something for over 50 years, expecting a desired effect, and it hasn't worked, let us try it another way, which is my way, and wind up getting the desired effect. And I believe that that is what the president and his backers, which is still white supremacy at play, we might see our folks, white folks rumble every now and then, like Donald Trump and all these other fellows out there putting on this great act. But we know they are in one camp. When the dust gets settled, it will be about the sharing of the spoils, and it will all be divided among their kit and kin, their kind. And as always, we will be left out in the cold. So I think the president has followed. He's a very intelligent man. Let's not, you know, we have to give that to him. But still, many intelligent folks among our race has not lived up to our expectations. And so I will not deny him his intelligence, but he's there to do a job. He's the president of the United States, and he's there to see to it that white supremacy reigns supreme over all of us. And I think he followed his script, the script that was handed to him. He followed it well, and he deviated a few points in his speech. He deviated a bit, but I think all in all, he tried to present a speech that would give something to everybody. I think that's what he was trying to pull off. It didn't work the way most of us conscious people wanted it to go, but it didn't work that way. But he tried. I had some problems when he spoke about the right of return, and I believe that the president really was talking about the right of return of those hoodlums in Miami, for lack of a better name term. And I think his idea about doing it a different way, dealing with Cuba in a different way, is to flood Cuba with a whole lot of small Trojan horses, bearing gifts of that includes political conformity, as this kind of so-called democratic process we have here in this country. That is what they want to unleash on Cuba. They want to also, within those Trojan horses, would come economic and social changes, racism, white supremacy. Again, the Miami Cubans, they want to unleash them on Cuba. The decadence and all the decadence that goes with white, with imperialism. And so it bothers me, again, with this talk of the right to return. Because the president, I don't believe, would take a trip to, for instance, the Middle East, to Israel, the state of Israel, and stand in front of those folks in the Knesset, or any public place in Israel, and tell those people about the right of the Palestinians to return to their land of their birth in Palestine. I don't think he would have that kind of cojones to do that. And I find oftentimes the president goes to places where my mother, they have an old saying back home, that call Noah weak fence there. Right? He goes to places, he tailors his speeches to the places where he goes geographically and to the people that he's dealing with. When he goes to Africa to address those African leaders down there, he can beat them over the head and talk about corruption and all those things. But he's really addressing the corruptees. He's not talking about the corruptors in the industrial world, the free world that is making these little fellas down there, corrupting them, are robbing them of our resources, plundering the country. They know where all these fellows, the ill-gotten gains that they have gotten from the industrialized world. They know where those money are put, because they're put in industrial countries' banks in the U.S. and Switzerland, Britain, and all these places. And if they wanted to curb the behavior of these corruptees in the African continent and the Caribbean and so forth, they could easily do so. But that is a part of how imperialism works, in corrupting those underneath us. And the moment they deviate from the plan, then they will grab a hold of all the funds in the banks, that the foreign banks and so forth, and so forth. And I would like to say that President Raul Castro, he countered the president on some of the things that he talked about, human rights, for instance. It bugs me to no ends when the United States, of our country, goes all over the world and preaching to people about human rights and the lack of human rights in this country that is facing them every day. They don't want to deal with it, but they can go all over the world and tell people about human rights. The president, Raul Castro, mentioned to him that the part of human rights is also about a good education for your people, good health care and all these other things, something that they don't want to deal with here in this country. And when I sat here listening to that speech, I kind of wished, I longed for the Fidel of old, because I would love to see Fidel on that stage, standing next to the president and countering him with all the foolishness that he was saying to them, because I know he would have been no match for Fidel Castro, when Fidel was Fidel. And so I long for that type of discourse. And so I was not really impressed by the president's speech, again, because I know he went there to do a job. And I don't care whether it's a black man in the White House or a white man in the White House. We as African people in this country, we will continue to catch hell until we have the power and the consciousness to listen to people such as yourself as to how we can get ourselves out of the trap that we are in. And we, this political system that we have here, It's not for us. It is not working for us. It has not worked for us. And it never will work for us. And we have to sit with folks such as yourselves and conscious leaders and figure out how we can get ourselves out of the mess we are in. Because we have too many charlatans, the black congressional caucus and all those folks out there that are looking there out for their own interests. They have cast their lot with Hillary Clinton and the Clintons and the Democratic Party and so forth. And they are not there working our interests. And so I hope that somewhere along the way, we will wake up as a people and have what those Christians call this great epiphany and understand that our interests are not being served by either of these political parties.
Well, thank you, sir. You said quite a bit today and always worthy of consideration. Thank you so much for contributing.
Thank you,
Mike. Let's talk to David from Brooklyn. Hello, David.
Hello, Trice. I mentioned it before. I want everybody to pray for you because of the mass prayer works.
Thank you. I feel it.
I'm glad. Whoever's not doing it, start doing it.
Well,
anyway,
so
I don't want to be all over the place like my musical taste.
So what are you contributing today?
I want to get back to Harvey. He never mentioned Nikola Tesla. And that would be the way to get rid of emissions and power the planet, and the whole cabal will crumble because they're making their money mainly off of the fossil fuels. Besides having the things.
So David, could you explain the concept that you're promoting and in identifying Nikola Tesla? Nikola.
Yeah, Nikola Tesla. Wasn't he Serbian? I think he was from Serbia. It doesn't matter where he's from. He was able to harness the energies of the earth. Do you remember Niagara Falls being powered just by what he does? It was a demonstration that all he did, I don't know what he did. I wish I knew. But whatever he did powered Niagara Falls, and he says he could power the world. And then J.P. Morgan says to him, where are we going to put the meters? Because all J.P. Morgan was into was making the money. He didn't care about powering the world. So if people would get together their free energy machines, which the government has most of them, illegally. There's an author, David Wilcock, who wrote a book called Sourcefield Investigations. He made a free energy machine. He went out with his kid to a ball game. He came home and they took everything. He said even the shower rods were taken because they found out he had a free energy machine. And I don't remember the man's name. He was going to demonstrate. And by coincidence, the night before, he was killed. So they'll do anything to keep this under wraps. I think this is one of their main secrets, besides extraterrestrials. It's even bigger than that. Did you hear about that?
You know, the name Tesla is actually coming back into focus because of the inventions that he came up with having to do with essentially harnessing energy in a very different way without requiring energy to harness energy. The motors and other inventions that he created, but certainly the auto industry would have been totally overhauled and totally changed if they were to have adopted his concept of an engine, which would pretty much require no fossil fuels whatsoever. I don't quite understand all of the details, but it's worth it's worth having a guest to tell us about Nikola Tesla and what he did and why his inventions stayed basically below the radar for so long.
Very.
Not that they weren't valuable. In fact, they were exactly the opposite. They were extremely valuable, but they could not – he envisioned essentially – a democratization of technology long before it was even conceived that technology should be for everybody. We see, of course, technology being harnessed and invented even to create even class divisions and make them even more rigid than before. His concept was that technology should be for everybody. And it should improve the lives of everybody. And it need not cost all this much money. That's hinting at your theory that one of the mysteries of how he died was he possibly assassinated. It's worth a look. I really would want to do something there. Very, very interesting. Thanks for planting the bug in my ear. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you.
From Alabama, Kerwin, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. Hello,
Hi,
Kerwin.
How are you feeling?
I'm fine. I'm
good.
As fine as I could be. Thank you.
Yes. And what I want to discuss today is the situation with the Missouri football players. And I think that's a very much significance because, I mean, these are some young guys who, you know, made a stand. I know when they made the stand to not to play, okay, I know they probably were threatened by the powers that be. You know how Europeans are. They threaten you that they're going to cut you off from your contracts. So they're going to cut you off from your, you know, all the funding they're giving you, your scholarship and stuff like that. However, what they did, they realized that when I think it was 32 or 33 of them, I'm not sure which one, how many it was, but they got together and realized that they're going to make this stand. And whatever they were making the stand for, I'm looking at the significance of it. These are young guys who said, well, look here, regardless of what the consequences are, we're going to get together, we're going to make a stand, and we're not going to play. As a result of that, look at the change that was made. And if you have pro players that are like the situation in L.A. with the Clippers, okay, all those black players had to do was not play. They went on complaining about this, that, or whatever. All they had to do was not play, which the playoff was coming up, and you would have seen a significant change. Here are guys that are not even in the pros yet, and I know these are young guys from, I guess, mostly from the St. Louis area, and I think we need to see the underlying principle that if we stand together and we're serious, we're not afraid, you're not concerned what the consequences are going to be, short-term or long-term, okay? Look at the significance of the change that could be made and look what it can be done. I don't see too many people.
Could you give us a little background, Kerwin, so that everybody appreciates the context that you're talking about here?
Okay. When it was something, I think the school, something was happening with the principal. They didn't like the principal, whatever. Like I said, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I know something that the principal, they didn't like what the principal was doing. And what they did, they were going to refuse to play some football games that were coming up. And as a result of them, 32 black players refusing to play a football game, several millions of dollars were going to be lost. So what happened was before the week came, when the game was supposed to be played, they got rid of the president and they got rid of the athletic director, and the coach was supposed to be on their side as well. Okay, but my main point is that the significance of when black males take a stand, and black women also, when we take a stand and we're serious and we're not afraid, that you can make changes, whether they be small changes or large changes, that change can be made. But you have to have the courage and the wherewithal to know that if you take this stand, that you know that in the long run, no matter what ridicule you have to go through, that a change can come. And I think it's very significant. And I don't hear too many people talking about it, just like it's been swept under the mat, per se. You know, I don't hear too many people saying that was real significant because something like that hasn't been done on that scale in a long time, you know. I think we need to look into these brothers who did that. I mean, we need to commend them because, you know, I'm sure that they was threatened with, we're not going to give you no jobs and get out of college because, you know, they call it blackball. But I don't see how it could be called blackball. I feel like it's whiteballing because black people are not the one to do it. So fact of being black, well, that's a term that should be wiped out of the dictionary, wiped because but they need to change the term to being whiteballed, because black people are not the one doing it, so it's impossible for them to be blackballed. They could be whiteballed, because that's what people who are doing it. But I just wanted to say that, and we need to look into that, and I think that aspect of it needs to be taught, not even shown to, you know, children, and because you know, we know the Oprah Winfrey's and your Tom Joyners and Steve Harvey, no, they're not going to say anything about that. I mean, and we don't even expect them to say anything about it. But that's something there that should be, you know, not swept under the mat, because I haven't really heard anything about it in a while, you know, since, except at the time they were doing it. And it's very significant that brothers will get together, and that should show you the power we have, and we stick together as one and be fearless.
Well, this is about the University of Missouri. There were complaints that had been lodged about racism on the campus. It's a four-campus system, and many students, African-American students, over a period of time had brought to the attention of the administration that they were subjects of racism and, extraordinarily bad treatment on the basis of race. They felt that the system was not responding to them as it should, that in fact the university president was ignoring it. And they decided then to make the point by the football team, which is highly respected as a pretty good team. They decided that they would take a leading role here in dramatizing the plight of African-American students on the four college campus. And they decided that they would boycott the games that they were scheduled to play, and there's a lot of money invested in these games, until the response was appropriate, and then that wasn't forthcoming, and they then upped the ante and said, well, we are now in it for the long haul, and now we're demanding the resignation of the president of the university system. So this was what galvanized the campus, and I really fell off the story since the last of it, but you're correct about the galvanizing of the four college campus and people who support these students in their struggle, and particularly they point to the football team and the exemplary action that they have taken, and it looks like things will be resolved as they want them to be resolved, with the resignation of the president and others in the administration who seem to have dismissed the students' complaints about racism on campus. But you're right. It's a story that should be, you know, should get a lot more coverage. But it is also a story about how, in so many ways, we see the lopsided economic arrangement, and that when you go for the pocketbook very often, that's where you get the problem solved.
That's where you get the problem solved, right. It's not the guns and the this, that. It's that pocketbook, right. And then the thing is, right, because, you know, they're so ingrained. I mean, their whole structure is built on the profit motive. You know, so it's not built on human suffering or people need better housing, people need better schooling, better jobs, better treatment, but it's all based on the profit. So what you have to go is that once you go at that juggler, you see, their juggler is the profit, their juggler. But if you go at that juggler, which is the profit, you see how automatically they just get as humble as a lamb, you know, because they don't want to upset, they don't want to forfeit that profit motive over anything else, because that's the main core of what they built their society on.
Thanks, Gerwin, for bringing this to our attention today. Thank you so much for participating.
And thank you so much. It's a great show, and I love it.
Thank you. I think so, too. And it's great because listeners are the star of this program and what they're thinking and what they're encouraging us to think. That's great. I love that. That means the radio program is serving the intended purpose, which is to expand the mind, to encourage people to talk to one another, and without fear, engage in conversation that may be a little bit touchy, but we're all grown up here. There's no need to pretend that there's another reality. We all know the reality that we're living in. We just haven't begun to talk about it, and we just haven't begun to accept the integrity of the arguments on whichever side they happen to be. But people are bringing the sum total of their experience, and that is really what matters. That's where the conversation starts, and that's where we start building community. Thank you so much. And thank you for keeping the level of conversation uniformly very high. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. It's the weekend. Relax. Take it easy with friends and family who bring positive dimension to your life. Absolutely avoid anything and anybody negative. You don't need it. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other on Monday. Bye-bye.